Good evening, everybody, and welcome. My name is Mary Martin. I'm a senior research fellow at the Civil Society and Human Security Research Unit here at LSE. And this event tonight is part of the unit's Security and Transition Research Programme. Just for your information, it's being recorded, so it will be available as a podcast if you want to experience it all again later. The Security and Transition Programme is an interdisciplinary investigation into the security gap. And what we mean by the security gap is the gap between how we conventionally think about and do security on the one hand, and the actual insecurity that people experience and what they themselves do to improve their own safety and well-being. And tonight we're here to discuss a topic which really pushes at those disciplinary boundaries and how we think about doing security. So it's probably a bit different from the kind of topics and themes that we normally investigate as part of our work on security and development. And the topic being, does theatre have a role, and indeed the arts and culture more generally, does it have a role to play in rebuilding societies which have experienced, or in some cases are still going through, different forms of violent conflict? I suppose usually when we talk about post-conflict reconstruction or conflict resolution, we talk about peace treaties, reforms to state institutions, transitional justice, economic development. And in fact, much of this kind of reconstruction is also done by external forms of assistance, foreigners coming into conflict zones. But within these interventions, arts still only play a very minor role. So the question, I suppose, tonight is, should we rethink the focus and the composition of those kinds of external interventions? Our understanding of conflict and security is increasingly shaped by what ordinary people do and what they need in order to improve their security. James Thompson, who is probably one of the best known, most prolific writers on arts, theatre and conflict, puts it like this, that conflict is no longer a distant battlefield, but close by in the street, neighbourhood or camp. And I think that's something that people in Paris only too well after this last weekend. But after war, the imaginative, emotional and intellectual life of societies also needs to be rebuilt alongside law and government and economics. So how do you integrate art and theatre into conflict resolution rather than simply reflecting or responding to violence? So to explore that sort of theme, I've got with me a very distinguished panel of practitioners tonight. On my left is David Land. David is a playwright, a theatre director, and a social anthropologist. Since 2000, he has been artistic director of the Young Vic Theatre in London, where he's produced more than 150 shows, directing, amongst others, A Raisin in the Sun, Dr. Faustus, Joe Turner's Come and Gone, as well as You Like It in the West End. He's also the author of an acclaimed anthropological study, Guns and Rain, Guerrillas and Spirit Mediums in Zimbabwe. He chairs the Belarus Free Theatre and is a co-director of the project World Stages. He's received numerous awards, including an Olivier and a CBE, and not least, he's an LSE alum, so welcome back, David. Indeed. On David's left is Charlotte Onslow. Charlotte has worked, she has a decade of experience in peace building as a practitioner. Since 2014, she has headed International Alert. International Alert is a renowned peace building NGO. And since 2014, she has headed their new programming area on arts-based peace building. And her growing portfolio of activities includes arts in the Syrian crisis and culture as a vector for peace in South Asia. And on Charlotte's left is Christian Colici, who is artistic director of Intent New Theatre. Christian and I founded, with help from others who are also in this room, Intent last year to develop contemporary political theatre in Kosovo and enable Kosovan artists to connect with the international arts mainstream. Kristrom is also on the board of the National Theatre of Kosovo. He's an award-winning director and has taken successful productions of UK plays such as After Miss Julie and Closer to Kosovo. He's also a human rights activist who, through the NGO he founded in 2003, works on issues of transitional justice, reproductive health, democracy, and integration. And he recently made a series of documentary films called People and Memories Talk with civilian victims of atrocities in Kosovo and throughout former Yugoslavia. So that's our panel tonight. Please give them a welcome. David, can I start our discussion by asking you about the ability of theatre to bring about social and political change, including the transition from conflict? How exactly does that transformative power work?
That's a question I can't answer, and I'm willing to try. The best I can do is two reflections on the way I see theatre from my perspective, and the way I try to work in theatre. I mean, as you say, I run a theatre, by which I mean I'm artistic director of a theatre, and I've been doing that for quite a long time now, about 15 years. Before I talk about that, I hadn't meant to talk about this, but as you started talking, it occurred to me that I should do is just to mention a rather extraordinary thing that's happened at the refugee camp in Calais, popularly known as the jungle. And I guess people will have images in their mind of what that refugee camp is like, and I believe there are now 7,000 or 8,000 people there. About 6 weeks ago, maybe 2 months ago, two very relatively young theatre makers, two guys in their late 20s, for no reason that I know, no professional reason, no reason in their histories, just decided to go to Calais and see, in simple terms, what was going on there. And met people as you do, and hung out as you do, and spent a couple of nights there. And one of the things they noticed, and there may be people in the room who've been there and know much more about that, but noticed that amongst other things going on during the evening, what there was dance, and there was singing. And to some extent, there were people telling stories. And I don't want to say that that was what you might call storytelling in any kind of, sort of folkloric way, but people were talking about their experience, but they were also doing the dance of the place they come from and singing the music that they came from. And these two guys thought, okay, what can we do? Perhaps what we can do is help to provide a place, a theatre, in which those events can take place. And they came back to London, they raised some money, they got a whole group of people on board. And there is now, in the jungle at Calais, a theatre called the Good Chance Theatre. And there's quite a lot of information about it online now, and it's a film. And it's really clear, if you look at that film, that the existence of a space in which what might have previously felt like random events, which weren't especially valued by the very special kind of community that has developed there, is now valued, has changed the nature of what people are doing. And it's allowed people from outside the camp to value it in a particular way. So I find that interesting. Okay. It's provisional, it's temporary, but anyway. Put that to one side. I'd just like to describe briefly the way I see the job I do. Okay, there are many different ways to run a theatre. And there is a kind of continuum, I suppose, with the commercial theatre on one side, and the kind of theatre I run, which is a theatre that has public investment in, on the other. And there's an enormous amount of crossover. But if I can distinguish between the two in this way, that if you run a commercial theatre, the way you do it, by and large, is you make a decision about the work that you're going to produce. You may do market research. You may decide that there is an audience, or you may hope that you have you know, confidence that there is an audience for a particular kind of work, particular show, particular actors, whatever. And you produce that, and you make it available to the audience at a particular price. But there is no particular concern with who that audience is. The audience is simply the people who will pay the price that you have set. And the relationship between the producers and the audience is such that the producers will constantly drive the price up to the point that the market will bear. Okay. And you have no greater interest in the audience than the time that they spend in the theatre and the financial exchange that is made. Okay. I've simplified that. I've caricatured, but nonetheless, on the other side. On the other side, there are the many cultural organisations in this country that have a different perspective. And the perspective is something like this. And I'm describing this from my point of view. I am a producer, and what I do in my day job is I have ideas with my team for the shows that we should produce, and then I take responsibility for them, putting them together and creating them. But I do another thing as well, which is that I create an audience for that work. And we do that in many different ways. We do that by getting to know our neighbourhood in some detail. I have a team of people whose full-time job it is to go out into the schools, the colleges, all kinds of social groups, and interest people, if we can, in coming and spending time with us in our theatre. But my real job is to create the relationship between the work and the audience. So the real goal of a theatre like mine is to create the relationship which has its fullest expression in memory. What we're really doing is creating memory of good experience. And one of the ways in which I try to think about what we do and the building that I run is that it's a place in which strangers can come together in peace. It seems to me, until you asked me to come and talk on this panel, I hadn't thought about that idea in terms of conflict resolution. But if one's thinking about, and your question is, what is the role of theatre? It seems to me the role of theatre, or the arts generally, but the performance arts is what I know about, is to try and recreate a relationship of the greatest possible intimacy between different groups of people. And although it's kind of heretical to say so, it seems to me that it doesn't so much matter what the play is or what the show is. I mean, within reasonable bounds, I guess. But the real value of what you're doing is the creation of a relationship in which it is clear that the artists are giving everything, that there is an act of generosity. And whether that is to an audience down the road in Waterloo, or whether it's in a refugee camp in Calais, or whether it's in former Yugoslavia, the same principle, I think, applies.
So it's not just the safe space, it's a space that enables certain interaction, certain confidence and social relations to unfold.
Well, I think the thing about creating art is that there It's not principally a market exchange or a financial exchange. It's a gift. And it's an act of generosity. You can't put price. If you go and see a play or you go to an exhibition, if you go and see an exhibition and you pay £15 to go in, you don't come out thinking, well, that was worth sort of £14.50. That's not the nature of the experience. If it's a good experience. And I think the distinctive thing that art can bring to the situations that you're drawing our attention to is that you can feel lucky, create a circumstance in which people are there in their fullness, in their wholeness, in their completeness, and offer that as a gift to people who may be in need of that kind of
does, if at all, does the state or governments come in to that picture? Because I mean, governments often have a rather fraught relationship with the arts for artistic or financial reasons. In the kind of context that we're thinking about, where states are dysfunctional, where there is conflict, how does the relationship between the state and the individual coming as an audience and the performer come in? I mean, should theatre be in conflict context, you know, there's a need for stability and security. So should theatre make people feel safe and secure and support the status quo, or should it be anarchic?
Well, it depends on the state, I think. I mean, I don't think we can generalise about, I mean, if we want to talk about a state like France, or one could be talking about a state like Lebanon, or one could be talking about a state like Congo. I mean, one will have very different relationships with the centres of power in that way. I think the relationship between a state, a government, power, and art is always one of ambivalence. One is always grateful for public investment, government money for the arts, but you can't fake the kind of relationship that I'm trying to describe. There is a certain kind of, well, there used to be. I mean, thank God the British Council has, over the last 15 or so years, 20 years maybe, has completely rethought its role in the world, instead of exporting what we, you know, might have thought of as cultural product, ghastly expression, to other parts of the world. Now the focus is on exchange and collaboration, which is much more helpful, I think, is a way of thinking about. But the fact that the British government is currently supporting the translation of all the plays of Shakespeare into Mandarin doesn't feel to me like it's... I don't see that there's an obvious connection between that and improving the norm, but improving, you know, to be crass about it, human rights in China.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not a cultural contribution. That seems to me a particular value. That state-to-state cultural exchange is very, very hard to get right.
Yeah. We'll come back to that role of outsiders, but Charlotte, can I turn to you? Tell us a bit about the kind of programs that you're doing and why you think that link between arts and peace building works, or maybe it doesn't, maybe you're still experimenting.
Yeah, we are very much experimenting, actually. And I've been thinking about why the arts haven't really been part of peace-building interventions up until now. I mean, you could argue, and I'll maybe speak a bit about that in a minute, that there is a nascent field growing. I think you could certainly say that. But there's something about the sort of Western liberal peace-building model that doesn't invite the messiness of culture and arts, which is more human and emotional and psychological, as you referred to it in your introduction. It's a very kind of focused on rational institution building, often conflated with state building and market-based reform, and where does arts play a role in that? How do we create space for that? It's highly technical, it's very top-down, and sort of marginalising that local, cultural, historical context. And I think that reliance on the rational and the cognitive, I think people are beginning, donors, funders are beginning to see that there's a gap, that this top-down approach is not proving to be the answer in these, you know, in the uptick of conflict and violence that we've been seeing in the last, let's say, 5 years. Certainly, you know, this is just an example of that, that this violent extremism trajectory. It's not necessarily working with all the answers, and the phenomenon of violent conflict is multifaceted, and we need to come at it from multiple perspectives. The emotional, the human, psychological that I mentioned earlier. And actually that's a sort of a long-winded way of saying how we've come to the arts in peacebuilding. We felt intuitively as a peacebuilding organisation that we've taken a liberal peacebuilding approach or sort of analytical lens to our work, very much building the conditions or help and support the conditions of the peace in the places where we work through engagement with institutions and policies, which is fine, and we'll continue to do that. But there seems to be this gap. We have, in International Alert, we have this, what we call the five peace factors. It's safety and security, political voice, well-being, justice, and the sort of economic conditions of peace. And well-being always seems to sort of fall on the sidelines. We sort of, we talk about it, but we never know how to sort of explicitly design programs or work with partners to really
It's a lovely fuzzy
build on
concept.
That. Yes, it is fuzzy and it's lovely. But for me, the arts has been working on the arts and seeing how it already is cropping up and has done a lot in our programming. How actually it is supporting the well-being peace factor, if you like. So we have several projects running at the moment, one of which has just started, which is particularly interesting, which is it's called Create Syria. We don't work in Syria because we can't, but we work, as you like, on Syria with the displaced Syrians in Lebanon. And we're working, and actually it's a British Council funded project, because what they obviously they're a cultural institution, but they more and more see the siloed way of working between culture and development as problematic. And it's been a very pleasurable working relationship in that they came to us and said, we know you're beginning to think about arts and peace building and how it functions in your programming. Help us design this with a cultural organisation in Lebanon. And so our partner there is a cultural institution. It's a Syrian-based independent cultural institution. And in effect, it's trying to create and support artists, Syrian displaced artists, to execute projects which they would otherwise normally have done maybe at home. So they're already artists themselves, they're not trying to create artists out of nothing, and give them funds to start building projects around dialogue and resilience and displacement. And it's a very broad call in that they can, the project can pretty much be anything, just as long as it looks at the dialogue component and has a notion of resilience, which is debatable and we discuss it. And that's just come out now, and we'll see how it goes. I'll come back to you next time and tell you how it went. But that's one component. And it could be anything from theatre to photography to street art. We'll try to keep it as broad as possible. And then we do a little bit of theatre work, but this is very much, my sense is, and this is in Pakistan, it's on sexual violence and the prevention of sexual violence at a very local level. I mean, that's a different way of model working. It's working at the community level and engaging with local people, just helping them design and write their own plays and role plays around the issue that confronts them around certain types of violence. But again, dialogue plays a very key role in that work. It's a little bit more of a traditional development model, I would say, about awareness raising through the arts.
I mean, my original question to David, and I suppose thinking about that now, was what is it about theatre that is transformative? I mean, a lot of the projects, it seems, are kind of performance or the doing bit of the arts, particularly theatre. I mean, the other dimension is theatre as a sort of social institution in fragile societies. You know, that we talk about government institutions or different kinds of reforms, but you know, theatre as a kind of a. I remember Christian when you first came to the UK and actually went to the Upper Vic. You were so surprised that it's a cafe, it's a restaurant, it's a meeting place. It also produces amazing theatre. So. It's that idea as well that, you know, theatre has a kind of wider cultural role than just people putting on performances. Christian, can I ask you, I mean, actually a personal question, because you grew up, you were a teenager during the war in Kosovo. What attracted you to theatre? Because at that time, no theatre in Kosovo, no good examples of theatre, so why did you want to be a theatre director?
I don't know. Maybe I was naive. Yeah.
during the occupation from 90s, I don't know if you know the context of Kosovo, or the context, but highlighted like this. We have been part of Yugoslavia, then 90s, we have been part of Serbia. And from 90s to 1999, there was only one theater in the entire Kosovo for Albanians, so-called the Doma. So it was very small theater. Mm-hmm. And usually they produced only comedies, you know. No good quality, there have been domestic kind of jokes and et cetera, but the people had only thing to do except going to the bar and have a beer, going to that theater. They had a lot of outfits, so they did some massive Dodona, 100 seats, very small, still existing actually. And then after the war, and of course I went also there because it was quite trendy for Pristina guys. We couldn't go nowhere, you know, so we went there and see some comedy, and it's quite trendy. And then after the war, I was in the high school, and National Theatre was producing Wizard of Oz and Children's Theatre. And it was a kind of public call for young people who will play kind of third roles or fourth roles, kind of statists there in that big production. And I applied, and I won a role playing a tree. So again, it was more, I didn't find that I loved theater, or I loved directing, or I loved acting, but it was not, again, more as a trendy, so I'm glad to go there. And while playing the tree, I was seeing the director, leading the process. So the process for me, even though that director is not so good now, I don't like him anymore, but during the time, he was kind of quite inspiring for me. The process was quite inspiring for me. So it was a theater show, some music, some songs, children. So I like the process a lot. I like the process a lot, and I like specifically I like the role of the director. Maybe it's my type of person being kind of leading, kind of being the first one. So. And then from the period, I never played anymore, so I didn't like the stage. And actually, I don't know why, but I didn't have a good feeling in premiere and rehearsals of the show. Because even now, when I have a premiere of my shows, in the end, in Kosovo, it's a common, the director goes to the stage and, you know, thanks the audience there. I'm so afraid to do that in that moment. I'm really afraid of being on the stage. So I think this is the reason that I had a trauma during the Wizard of Oz, so I thought it's better being behind the scene. And even now, when I'm doing rehearsals, very few times I go on the stage. I don't like going on the stage. I don't know why. I'm just going behind the scene, especially when I'm doing rehearsals with the actors, you know, because when I'm doing whatever things with the set director, everything, I have to go out to be there. But when I'm doing rehearsals, I don't like being on the stage. So.
Tell us about current state of theatre in Kosovo. And so you set up a tent. What do you think that can contribute, and in which kind of ways to Kosovo's rather troubled transition from conflict?
Yeah, I'd like to answering your question. I'd like to connect also to what David said, that this relation between government and theatre and audience definitely. It depends on different kind of countries and different kind of political context, time. In Kosovo now, theater, first, it's not the mainstream. It's not a lifestyle like it's in London or in Western Europe. So theater somehow it's a lux, if you can say it. Even the government, when they do the budget for culture, not only for theater, but including other fields, whatever, visual arts, film, they are really giving a small amount of money on culture. And actually, somehow they see that it is a stereotype in Kosovo that the artist needs to be poor. They don't deserve money, so they have to work without money. Because they are bohems, they have to drink, but they don't need money. And it was very strange. It was the Dodona Theater, they had a kind of a ceremony or something like that. It was opening ceremony of a theater festival, but for children, and the director of theater, who is an old director, but also theater director, said that kind of being proud how the artists work without money, without payment, so somehow kind of promoting the stereotype, in front of the politician, they do mm-hmm. fool the politician, that's of course. So, I don't know, theater, and it's quite complex. There are some theater shows who have a great audience, and there are some theater shows who don't have an audience, but it's something that will be depending to the artists who are directing the show. So we don't have a kind of theater as an institution per se, with all components, starting from production, PR, audience development. Normally this is science fiction in Kosovo. We are doing this really kind of straightforward way, producing, and then you're just putting a small poster there, and who comes, who don't comes, and that's all. Another thing that is missing in Kosovo is independent theater. There is one national theater in Pristina, who have a good money from the government, but other theaters in other cities, they don't have money at all. And we have a few independent theaters who are trying to survive with these kind of projects. You know, those donors and etc. So that time to time I have a feeling that they are doing superficial work on theater. So they're doing, for example, we had some cases doing theater shows in the name of reconciliation with Kosovo and Serbia, but they've been so kitsch, so superficial. So I didn't like that, you know, frankly speaking. You know, if you, and sometimes I think the theater have a good role saying something that nobody can say it in public. You know, saying something that even Albanians have done some crimes against Serbs, for example, after the war. Because you cannot say this in Kosovo in the media or in the public. Everybody knows that after the war, even Albanians have done some crimes against Serbian civilians. But theater can say it, and this is something that we can use theater. You know, to say something that cannot be said in the public. I don't know. Maybe I'm talking too much.
No. We're going to see a film that Intent made, or a workshop in a minute, but perhaps you just describe a little bit and put into context what it is we're going to see.
Yeah, actually, Men was in Kosovo, and I met Mary accidentally, and then I had a show in National Theatre. It was Patrick Margaret's show after Miss Julian. Then we started to talk about theatre, and we started to talk about this complex situation in theater in Kosovo, including education, because we have a very weak education in our theater, in our Academy of Arts. And then we have started to brainstorm and discuss about a lot of ideas with Mary, and we created this Intent company, which has three or four missions, kind of capacity building, education, producing, and touring, you know, exchange. And we needed something to do immediately, and we've done a workshop in Pristina with Pericles Nolan, bringing artists from UK and giving the lecture in Pristina, a workshop actually. And we did this with an open call. It was a two-day workshop. And we had only 15 kind of places, and we had more than 120 applicants. So it was really, as you can see, I have to tell you, because Kosovo is full of youth. So 40% of the Kosovo population are youth. They have a lot of energy. I think that we have a lot of potential, but we are super isolated, you know, politically, artistically, and et cetera, et cetera. So when Pericles came, we did a 2 day workshop with actors, directors, and writers. And the workshop was kind of structured that we will do three small pieces written from writers immediately then, and then also rehearsing a bit, and then showing it. So I think you will see a very short video seeing this process, seeing this super energy of Kosovo, our artists. That positivity that they have, even though they are isolated, they are living in super ghetto in the middle of Europe. And it's quite inspiring.
Okay, so should we, it's about 8 minutes long, so if we just, we're gonna show it on here, Dominika, yeah? Mm-hmm. So if I move up the way.
Hold on! 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 Hold freedom is to face the truth. Like women that are raped in war, and like everyone, we are afraid to tell the truth.
We need basic needs, but that's also,
but
I consider freedom. Yeah, but I consider that freedom also. Because that's element to life. And if you are not free to access them, then, you know, you are not free.
The fact that you gathered here today is the fact that you are free.
For me as an artist, I can tell the truth here, but when I go out, I cannot tell the truth, because deep inside, maybe I'm afraid.
I hope you can show me
She remembered very well when the Serbian police started with the poison. Aren't you sure, Rebecca?
In year 2000, I was a kid. I came to Kosovo for the first time, and I found out that they murdered 30 members of my family.
She was at the roof of a house, and they saw live the process of Reichstag massacre. They didn't know what is happening until they saw the news.
I was very young. I remember my beautiful house before the war. It's dark, no electricity. We were singing, me and my family.
Is it a good thing or a bad thing to be reminded of the feeling?
Sometimes it's a good thing because I'm alive and I can express myself, and those feelings are powerful because sometimes we need some to remind some bad feelings to make us stronger, that we are alive, we are free, and we can tell whatever we want now. Because I was 7 years old, and it reminded me that I was with my son of uncle, so we were just me and him together in one house, and at that time the Serbs came to that house, so we were running like kids. We didn't know what is going to happen. We know that it's a war, but not that they are going to do something with us or whatever. So we went to the uncle house where we were all the family, and the son of my uncle disappeared. So when the Serbs came to the house, they wanted him, where is the kid? And they beat my uncle and his other son.
Are you alone? Is anybody else in the house?
Are you sure there's nobody else in the house?
Yes.
Okay. Are you hiding any guns? You have a gun? Oh, you have a gun?
Turn around.
Turn around!
Good.
Play. Play.
And smile. You know what? Stand up. Play and smile and close your eyes.
Day of Kosovo. It was very, very, very cold, and I thought that it's a day that I'm gonna be happy. I was with a friend of mine. She was with Vet Vendosia, and she said, no, this is a fake independent.
So in that sense, a fake independence.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Then I came back in my country from USA after three years, and I see for first time my country with freedom. That was very interesting.
And after all of this, Kosovo is still one of the most isolated places in Europe.
If you could write, perform, say anything you wanted to say, what would it be?
I would try to do something about being ourselves.
I'll just say all the three pieces actually show that even the characters do not have power in any of the situations. And even at the cost of taking it, making a decision, actually the decision is made and it hurts the others. I mean, that's universal everywhere, but all the three pieces actually have that, the powerlessness and at the same time hurting your mother or hurting others. So it's kind of the cost of decisions in Kosovo. If you take a decision, make a decision, it is going to hurt others.
I will just like shortly to say that what we learned from these three pieces is that we had a love between Albanian and Serbs, then the war started and then the war ended, but we still continue to be the marionettes of somebody or something.
But you can see, I think, the kind of energy and enthusiasm that actually that process of making theatre unleashed. So it was very inspiring, actually, to be part of that. And to say afterwards, there are people, Rebecca, who you saw in the film, who is Christian's associate, is also in the room, so you do feel free to ask her. Can I ask, or before I open this up to a wider discussion, can I ask all three of you? So one of the reasons that Intent exists is it's a collaboration between UK theatre professionals and Kosovans. And that workshop you saw was facilitated by a British actor. It was funded by offwestend.com, which is a UK organisation which promotes fringe theatre here. And there are other examples in International Alert's work, and David, you're involved with the Belarus Free Theatre, of good kind of collaborations and working together to develop theatre as a tool of reconciliation and dialogue. So my question is, and we're also speaking about, I guess, a kind of golden age for UK theatre when it's extraordinarily vibrant here. Is this a good use of British soft power? You know, there's certainly a current fashion for taking Shakespeare around the world, but could one see this maybe as a new form of colonialism, which actually suppresses local voices when that's what we need to be doing if we're thinking about theatre as a tool of peace building? So,
shall I have a go?
Have a go.
There are a few pairs of words I dislike as much as soft power. It's a really horrible expression. And that's because
we're in the international relations.
I'm so sorry about that. Nonetheless, you'll have to forgive me. I think it's an unfortunate idea. I thought the most powerful thing in that film was when Emily asked the group, I think, if you could create anything that you wanted to, what would you do? what would it be about? And the guy replied, it would be about us. I haven't got it exactly, but it would be about ourselves. It is. And I guess, I said something about this earlier, I suppose, and the people in the room, infinitely more experts at the hard end, at the tough end of this than I am. But I suppose the thing about violence is that its purpose is to destroy. But if it doesn't actually destroy, if it doesn't actually kill, it's to dehumanize. What we know about people is people are infinitely complex and have infinite potential. And violence is destructive of that potential and of that complexity. And I guess what we can offer is a recognition of people's humanity and complexity. And that, in my view, isn't achieved by, you know, I have nothing against Royal Shakespeare Company, it's a wonderful company, but taking the Royal Shakespeare Company production of The Merry Wives of Windsor from my perspective, that's soft power, I suppose, and that's not what I'm interested in anyway. I'm interested in the way, if ways exist, of people recognising their common humanity, I suppose, and the performing arts, whether it's dance or theatre or singing or music, is one of the ways in which that kind of relationship can be created. That's the value of it.
Charlotte, are you a neo-colonialist?
No. I think I'll pull down a bit on your side. So for International Alert, what we try and do is facilitate the conditions and support artists in their local context. And convince donors that have the funds to help that happen. So I probably, if I was thinking about that arts-based peacebuilding program, I wouldn't be thinking about taking something from either Europe or the UK and trying to facilitate that cultural dialogue. I leave that to the British Council. And I think that's, for me, it's the integrity of the artist at the centre of our arts peacebuilding work. That is really, really critical. Like, it's an important principle of our work to allow for that artistic integrity to come out and that human, local context to be explored through either, as you say, the performing arts or photography or whatever it might be. What we try and bolt onto that or facilitate is that the dialogue spaces are there. And it could be dialogue through the art itself or dialogue that happens before or afterwards. That's the way that we try and design our programming in collaboration with our partners. But I'm not a proponent of exporting or even cultural exchange, really. I think that can be, we could probably draw on our cultural heritage through the design of our work, which I would do.
Christian, what's your take on this? I know we were having a conversation earlier today, I think, in which Rebecca said it's great, you know, as a Kosovan artist to come here and learn from UK theatre, but, you know, maybe the experiences just don't align themselves, because trying to make theatre in the context where you're making it with political constraints, self-censorship and so on. So these are two very different kind of contexts which don't really marry.
But that's for sure. For your information, Kosovo as a new country needed to write and to approve a lot of laws, all laws from the beginning, from scratch. And most of the laws have been copy-paste of international laws, especially in Europe, and they have not been adapted for Kosovo circumstances. And in the beginning was the same also about this cultural initiative, about colonization. They were coming from different kind of countries. Kosovo was very open, we loved foreigners, we loved international community, because we are, thanks to them, we are now an independent country. But they were coming, they felt consulting the base, without consulting the community. So they're just bringing their ideas, and from that, and bringing the ideas with their agendas. So in the name of reconciliation, they were doing a soccer game or exhibition, drawing two bears kissing each other, and now there is reconciliation. But now I think that this cannot function anymore. If you like to collaborate, you cannot come there in Kosovo and be the boss. You have to consult the community. You have to include the community in the process of designing any kind of initiative. And this is what I said in the beginning, because there have been a lot of theater shows invested from EU and from different kind of international funds, but they had a different kind of specific agenda. They were not interested in quality, they were not interested about quality of actors or director or writing or piece. They had an agenda being so superficial and so ugly and so kitschy. But the problem was that they had money, so they toured all around Kosovo everywhere. So because it was a typical kind of socialism way of thinking theater, you know, brainwashing and sending a message. But they are so kitsch, and the people are not stupid. So if there is a need for collaboration, there is a need in Kosovo, especially if we like to collaborate in the political aspect, we definitely need to shake the ground, to shake the society, to tackle something that is really connected to the community.
Shall we open it up? We'd like to hear from the audience. So are there any questions to any of the panelists or points that you would like to make, having heard and seen what we've seen already?
Yeah. Just a simple one on your title there. You're saying, can drama build peace? Who in this context do you want to bring build peace with? I mean, what is the conflict that you want to resolve? And what is going to, you know, where is it going to lead to? I mean, what are the parties that need to be put at peace? I mean, that is the question.
It's a good question. It's a question that, from the perspective of where we're working, there are multiple conflicts at every level. And if I were to think about the work that we're doing in Lebanon with Syrian displaced people, refugees, the conflict is specifically between Lebanese communities and Syrian refugees, and that tension that is growing increasingly with over a million refugees and 4 million Lebanese, and the conflict over resources and where that money's going to. And the tensions that are arising are not being dealt with effectively by the institutions, and can we offer some kind of space that is a humanising space where we can share any form of art, artistic endeavour. So that's in a very specific conflict context, but I mean, you could take any of our projects and it would be at a very different level. We haven't worked out or even haven't got an example of a higher level conflict that we're trying to engage on through the arts. So I'm waiting for that aha moment to happen in one of our contexts where we work, but to date we're in a very specific context, conflict context, local level.
And Kushtrim, in Kosovo, it's not just about Serb-Albanian, is it? I mean, I guess one of the things that film showed is that everybody is in some kind of conflict with the current political powers, the government.
Actually, in Kosovo, it's an international project, definitely. And I don't like to say it, but it is true that it's failing as an international project. It's not the loss of 15 years, a lot of investment, a lot of ideas, a lot of projects, a lot of strategies, but there is no improvement, there is no development. And after 15 years, people are now without hope, and people are eager to leave Kosovo. And how we can use theater in this case? Theater can be except entertaining them, especially in the relation to the conflict and war. Theater can tell the truth that the mainstream people cannot tell it. Theater can treat a subject or a topic that the mainstream or media or journalists cannot tell it in public. Because immediately you create a kind of distance, you know. It's not me, it's my personage. So, and there have been some cases, already, especially in Balkans, political theater is quite powerful now. In Kosovo, we are really in the beginning phase of this political theater. To tell you the context and our expectation, why now off very low, I will tell you one personal story. Then immediately after the war, I entered high school, and the fourth grade, the high school, the last kind of class, before entering the university, they had an excursion, kind of organized excursion from the Ministry of Education. And they went to Albania. And it was super enthusiasm. And one of those guys, I was in the first grade, told me that, oh, come on, Kosovo will be such a developing country with all this international community, with all these investments. When you will go on an excursion in the last of your high school, you will travel all around Europe. Even now, after 15 years, high school students of Kosovo are going only to Albania. So we can see the level of Kosovo as a country, the level of development. So it's quite pity, and it's about trust. We had a high expectation, we really trusted the international community, but it's not fault of the international community, that's for sure. It's fault of our political leaders. But we have that hope that the international community will intervene to our political structure and system to develop a proper democratic and society and develop society. And now there is a lack of trust even towards international organizations. You know? There is a kind of stereotype in Kosovo that they are coming here, they're getting good salaries and going back, they don't care about Kosovo anymore. So we can see how it's because there is no hope, you know? There is no prosperity in Kosovo. And this is something that's missing.
Yeah, I was wondering, you started originally talking about that in the theater you can say things that you couldn't say in the press, etc. And then you said that perhaps your self-censorship. Mm-hmm. And could you give us an example of something you said in the theater that you couldn't say in the press that really is there? No, is it really that open when you say too much anything you want to say?
Yes, of course. Actually, I mentioned a case. For example, you cannot, if this is related to war and to relation with Serbia, you cannot say in public discourse that there have been crimes against civilians of Serbs after the war from Albanians. Everybody knows that. There have been some, whatever, international attempts putting people to court, but with no success. But it's kind of forbidden to tell. Or, for example, we are aware that our political establishment is super corrupted and super, you know, it's worse ever. And you cannot say that freely in the media, and we cannot say it in public discourse, you know. And self-censorship comes because we are, Kosovo society is directly connected to the government in the sense of jobs, in the sense of education. The biggest employer in Kosovo is government, so we don't have a private sector. We don't have big factories. We have supermarkets, boutiques, and that's it. So the biggest employer in Kosovo is the government. And the government sees those employers as votes. So if you're going to say something, you will risk your future, job, or university, or theater, and et cetera, et cetera. But fortunately, there are some people, sometimes crazy, sometimes strange, that do not depend directly on the government. And we can say some truths. I'm working a lot in transitional justice, and transitional justice means dealing with the legacy of the war, including documentation, truth telling, etc., etc.
Should I take the group? I think because we've got more hands up now. Can I start in the middle and then behind you, and then maybe in the group?
How do you measure success in building case through drama? I mean, I've heard a lot about dialogue, and I'd love to hear more, you know, maybe unpack that a bit more, and what that actually means, and whether it's possible to quantify success. Is it an individual might have had a moment of experiencing one of the projects that you've been talking about, Charlotte, perhaps. I know that the project that you just started in Lebanon, but maybe a previous project that you've been a part of, a concrete example of where you've actually seen some kind of journey that the participants have been on, how that's impacted on them, and if you've got any, you know, contact with them still, what's going on for them.
So how do you measure success?
I've been trying to think a lot about how theatre or performativity itself becomes a bit intangible and therefore a bit more safe in places where things haven't been resolved. And I wonder what you think new media is doing to support or disrupt this. For example, if you say you can say something in the theater, but then you record it and it goes on the internet, are you still safe, or are you then changing the public space?
Often where there's a lack of hope, and where I've seen theatre at festivals internationally work really well, is when you share international work with that group of people to inspire them and to give them that sense of hope that this is all completely possible. How possible is it to create a festival within Kosovo that would share that work, international work?
David, you want to start? How do you measure success at the Young Vic? It's bums on seats, isn't it?
No, it's not actually. Well, it is partly, but it's not only. People don't come, then that's not the opposite of success, whatever that success is. It's a really difficult. I mean, it's a good question to ask, but it's a really difficult question to answer, because how do you measure the success of any work of art? You know. A painting by Rembrandt. How do you measure the success that that's had? How do you know what effect it's had over people who've looked at it over you? It's hard to. In order to run the theatre that I run, I need to raise quite a lot of money. And people always ask that question. That's the question of a funder. It's a funder's question. How will I know that the money that I'm giving you has had the effect you say it will have? And I always have the same answer to that, which is, I was saying something that started this about making the audience and making the work, right? And the answer I have from this is that if I'm standing in my theatre and the audience is the audience I want, which is to say a really complex audience, so the audience has made it people with money, people that have money, black people, white people, people who never go to theatre, people who go to theatre 3 times a week. If because we have the information, so you can tell. If that audience is engaged at a deep enough level with the show, with a piece of art, with a work of art, which I feel is totally personal, that I feel has the depth that I think great art can achieve. And if that relate, then I think that's successful. And if I stand in the room, I can tell. And if the funder wants to know, then I say to the funder, you know, come stand with me, and you will know. When there are, you know, when 10% of the house are people who are there for nothing and who live around the corner and who've never been to theatre before. I mean, the example I always give is we work with a director that people may know called Patrice Chereau, who died sadly couple of years ago, but Chereau was the great director of Europe for many years, and anybody working in theatre in Europe would know Chereau was the genius of European theatre, and he did a show with us, and it was a very, very fine piece of work. And in the audience were a bunch of kids who lived down the road and had never seen theatre before. And for me, watching those kids really engaged with that success, I can't give you a grant for it. I think if you watching that film, if you had been in the room, ask Emily, who was in the room, you know when it's happening, when that thing is happening, when some sort of, God knows how we talk about these things, it's really hard, but to use really crass, you know, when human contact has been made at a deep enough level, I talk about memory, when it goes, you know, when you remember it, and 10 years later and 20 years later, and at your worst moments, you remember that. And it's something like that.
Charlotte, are there metrics for measuring what you do with arts and feasibility? I mean, you're talking about, as David's described, it's a very difficult fit, isn't it, to kind of measure the impact of art?
Oh,
that's
so much to say. It is a funder's question, but also, and we have to answer the question for them, so I understand that and accept that. I also want to know, for me and for us as practitioners, what works and what doesn't work. And part of the, you know, it's not one of the major principles of designing the work and working with partners in peace building is conflict sensitivity and looking at the local context. We don't want to do any harm either. Or we want to do, let's say, safe harm. So as you were talking about, sort of agitating, using this to agitate, but then also that producing something positive and transformational at the end in terms of peace or conflict resolution. In a slightly facetious way, it depends what you're trying to measure. So, you know, you could measure the audience and say the diversity of the audience, and that's a number counter thing, and you can spot how many men, women, etc. How to measure sort of transformational personal change about the notion of the other and the enemy is much harder. And we do have to put it in the matrix a little bit, because we're working in all projects. We have multiple partners and everybody has to measure certain things. So you can ask people how they feel about certain things at the beginning, middle and end. What I'd really like to do, and what we haven't quite got to grips with, is using the art or the artistic content to show change. So what I mean by that is, if we're producing certain aesthetic works, how has that evolved over time? If you're, for example, an artist that's put in a proposal for a theatre piece and dialogue work in the Lebanese and refugee work, how are you conceptualising it at the beginning and how have you redesigned it towards the end to sort of incorporate notions of dialogue or the other, the enemy? So it depends what you're trying to measure. We can measure some things, other things are harder. We haven't quite found the language, because I think there's many intrinsic things to the arts that are not compatible with peace building and development and the model that you're talking about for the rational, accountable. And we need to be able to articulate that better. I wrote a piece on that recently for Open Democracy about how we need to learn the language, but we need to be able to express it, because we will be able to the more we work on it, the more we think about it.
Pushkin, social media, does that change what you can say safely or how you say it?
Frankly speaking, because of this not Russia, just to there are some few people who, through a short newspaper article or through a short piece, a small piece or whatever, can tell some truth that we need to view. But I'm talking about public discourse, how to bring a specific problem or challenge or issue or responsibility in the public discourse, because public discourse is totally controlled from the system. Kind of major media, etc. So in Kosovo, I can freely write the status in my Facebook, whatever, I like it, but it's about my impact. It's about the discourse that we have to create. Everybody knows in Kosovo, even the family members of our prime minister, that we have a super corrupt political structure. But the idea is that self-censorship. Are we eager to make a pressure and to bring it to the public discourse because of the consequences that we can have it? This is totally different.
Can you remind us of your question about
festivals?
And how possible that would be, it would obviously be a brilliant thing, because
we've seen it in all
different countries.
Actually, why we need the festivals? We need the festivals for artists.
Yeah.
Because Kosovo artists do not see a lot, so they are finishing the studies. They are working 95% of them only in Kosovo, and they are not seeing what is happening all around in the region, all Europe, or whatever. So we had some attempts at festivals. We had before seven years. We had a very good festival. It was funded directly from the previous president, and we brought it a great performance from all around the world. But it was the first edition, second edition, third edition that. You know. Because I'm board member of National Theatre, I'm making a lot of pressure to our Minister of Culture to allocate a specific amount of funds to refunction at the festival. And I totally agree, especially in this case of isolated countries, or in the case that artists don't have normal incomes to travel to London and see a performance, or travel to Berlin and see a performance, the festivals are great, And frankly speaking, again, especially for artists, those days of the festivals have been party, have been celebrating, literally celebrating, or seeing other performances.
More questions? Jeffrey at the back.
I'm just interested in the title about the politics of post-conflict and state transformation. Given that the President of France has just announced that his country is at war, I just have a suspicion that the implication of those sorts of statements and the environment that is encircling us is going to create, or has the potential to create, greater conflict in society in our own countries. And I just wonder whether the panel has any thoughts about, if that happens, how do we see the role of theatre in our countries? I know, alongside the role of theatre in places like Kosovo, but I suspect that this question about the politics of post-conflict and state transformation is something that could be much closer to home over the next few years, given the way events are sort of leading us or dragging us, perhaps.
Good. I think that's one for you.
Thank you.
What's going to be on our next programme?
Yeah, it's a big challenge. I mean, it's huge. I didn't know Keith Halon actually said we are at war. He said that. I suppose thank you very much. I suppose he said that now, and that is meaningful. And when I was in the anthropology department or in the philosophy department, or maybe even in the international relations department, when you say it, then it's real. And nonetheless, we've kind of been at war even before he said it, for quite a long time. I mean, since the invasion of Iraq, it's been non-stop war. And despite and the fact that a president or a prime minister hasn't declared it in those terms doesn't mean it hasn't been real. And it's certainly been real for the people who've been on the receiving end. And now we're beginning to be on the receiving end, and we feel perhaps collectively a bit different about it. I guess the thing is, I mean, it's why, sorry if I'm rude to people in international relations talking about soft power. I just think we have to, whatever happens, we need to resist rhetoric of that kind. It's not about power. We have to remember, the thing I think about a lot, and I was thinking about this when I was thinking about what on earth I would say this evening, and it's very simple, but it's something that comes back to me a lot, which is, Bertrand Russell said a hell of a lot of different things, but the thing I remember that he said, it's very simple, is remember your humanity and forget everything else. And I come back to that quite a lot. Just remember your humanity and forget everything else. It's going to be very tough times over the next God knows how many years. The value of art is that it, and I was trying to say this moments ago, is that it is human beings in as close and as deep contact with each other as it is possible. That's what it is. And when a Christian talks about the kitsch art, what I understand that to be is work which is not attempting to make a deep. It's irrespective of who the audience is. And that kind of relates to the question about social media and digital media and so on. The thing about film is a great art. Of course it is. But the film is the same whether there's 1,000 people watching the film or nobody watching the film. The film is still the film. The thing about theatre is that it is human beings in contact with each other. And that is different and that's special, whether it's dance or whether it's people. I mean the guy who brought his piano across half Europe to play outside that cultural organisation, which was, I mean, it's not chance that it was a sporting place and a cultural place. That was attacked, but that impulse to go, the only way I can resist what has happened is, I mean, who would have written it by playing Imagine by John Lennon? But the minute you hear it, you get it, you understand it, you know what he's doing. And it's communication, contact, associated with each other on that level that we have to somehow protect.
There's a question in the middle, and Rebecca. Yeah.
I've got a question for each of the panelists, and it's been fascinating. David, tell us a bit about the Belarus Free Theatre. Charlotte, I think what you're doing in Lebanon is incredibly important. Everybody talks about Paris, rightly so. But Beirut had a terrible bombing on Thursday night. I'd be very curious to know what your aim is in terms of developing the contact, which is obviously all the more important. And I could also ask Christian, tell us a bit about People and Memories, the documentaries that Mary says to do.
Good for Christmas. I'm not as free-tale, I'm trying to get as brief as I can, though they deserve much more time than I'm going to give them. Valerie's Free Theatre is a positional theatre that was based in Minsk. It was set up, I don't know how much people know about Belarus. It is, you know, frequently described as the last dictatorship in Europe. It isn't, unfortunately. There are others. It's not the worst dictatorship in the world, but it's a pretty bad one. And one of the ways in which the dictatorship functions is by, it's very much like you were describing, penalizing free thought, penalizing discussion, and the expression of dissent. And the city was set up by a very remarkable pair, Natalia Kalyada and her husband, Nikolai Kalezin, and another director, Vladimir Shevin, exactly 10 years ago, because we've just been celebrating the 10th anniversary of their formation. They operated underground in Minsk for many years. They also run a theatre school called Fortinbras, which is an active school, basically, in Minsk. And it does train actors and continues to do so, but more than that, its function is to be a kind of refuge for the intellect and the human spirit in Minsk. About 5 years ago, they were they left the country and they were banned. They weren't allowed to come back. They are the three main people, the three leaders of the company, aren't allowed to be in Belarus. And they are based in my theatre. They have a home in my theatre. They have an office and so on. They're an associate company with us. The acting school continues in Minsk, and they teach. They continue to teach the actors via Skype every day, and they create shows with the actors largely via Skype. And then the actors, of whom there are about 12 in the company, leave Belarus. We don't know how they leave. We do not ask that question. But they turn up either in London or New York or wherever it is they're playing. They tour quite widely in the world. And they have a repertoire of about 15 shows that they play quite widely. They're a really fantastic company. And I'm very pleased to be on that. I chair their board, actually, and it's a producer.
Charlotte, what difference will the deteriorating security situation in Beirut make to your programmes in Lebanon?
Or the other way around, is what I meant.
Sorry, the other way around, sorry.
The impact, what can you do given the situation as a theatre?
Right. In terms of the art, I'm not entirely sure. But the area where the bomb went off is where one of our partners are based, that we work with political youth wings and facilitate sort of dialogue between the diverse political actors of the youth wings. I don't know. I don't know how it's going to play out. It's a case of speaking to them on the ground, and our team is doing that. We have a very small team. There are about six Lebanese and other nationalities there. And we're just sort of monitoring really at the moment. As I say, the programming doesn't actually happen in that particular region, that particular neighbourhood, which is quite notorious for the sort of agitation and violence.
Christian, tell us about
People and Memories.
Yeah,
actually, this is a very important project for me as an artist and also as a human rights activist. This People and Memories talk deals directly with civil war victims. I was inspired from Steven Spielberg, recently, whatever reason, for 10 years or something, he started to collect memories of victims of the Second World War, because the victims, after 60 years, they are dying now, so you know, also their stories are dying, so he started to collect that on the drone camera. But he did that only for kind of archiving and documentation. And what conspired with the idea, I thought that Firstly, we have to give a platform to civil war victims to tell their stories, because their stories are all manipulated from the system, from political authorities, from the politicians, all this side, that side. So I thought that we have to create a platform which will invite civil war victims, Albanians, Serbs, Roma and other nationalities which have lost somebody or have had casualties of the war. So we are calling those narrative documentary films. We are shooting them with four cameras, and we have produced, firstly we have started with Kosovo edition. I have directed and produced 60 narrative documentary films with 60 stories and testimonies of civil war victims. And those have been broadcasted in national television in Kosovo every Monday in prime time. So after that, they had a two times kind of premiere and also reprisals. And then we have created an online platform, and we have uploaded all those films in peopleandmemories.org. So not only Kosovo people, but also people from all around the world can watch those movies. So first, we have created a platform for the civil war victims. Secondly, we are contributing directly to documentation of the past, of the war. And thirdly, we are making society and political spectrum under pressure about the needs of the civil war victims and about the past, which is very important to not be forget. After the success in cooperation and negotiation with a lot of artists and the stakeholders around this concept of dealing with the past, I started to produce, I'm actually in the final phase of producing narrative documentary films, the regional edition, ex-Yugoslavia War, so victims from Kosovo, Bosnia, Croatia, Serbia, Macedonia. And I've managed to produce in the now 30, I'm in the final phase of producing this 30, and we will broadcast the 30 narrative documentary films in 5 national televisions in Kosovo, Serbia, Croatia, Bosnia, and Macedonia. So it's a big coverage, it's Yugoslavia coverage.
Yeah.
And people in Serbia will hear the stories of the victims of Bosnia, Kosovo, Croatia, and vice versa. So it's going to be, I think there's going to be quite a political shock and political kind of turbulence all around this Yugoslavia, but at the same time, I'm a fan of dealing with the past as a concept. So societies have to face with the past. Unfortunately, some societies still are not ready, especially society from Serbia. And this is a platform that we will give the opportunity to face with the past that their politicians and structures needs to take responsibility.
We're running out of time, just enough time for a quick round. I know Rebecca had a question. Anybody else? Rebecca.
Maybe my question, I mean, it's not actually a question, but I just wanted to tell you about something that actually left an impression on me. I saw the play that was, it's Romeo and Juliet, which is a co-production between Serbs and Albanians. So it actually premiered and it was played in Pristina, and then I had a discussion with the actor who's Serb. And to me, I mean, I find it interesting that I think you need to believe that you can change something or someone through theater, otherwise it's pointless actually doing it. Do you actually need to believe that you can change, and can you change something or someone? Because the actor was telling me that for him, it was a major step that he had actually come to Kosovo and saw Albanians for the first time in his life, and they were not the crazy animals that he thought they were. So he was telling me that he did not actually believe that theater can change anything apart from him. So it's this between, do you as an actor need to believe that you can change something, or do you do it just for yourself, for your sake? And it's this kind of, just the thinking that actually I got from this. Mm-hmm. Can you change the world? You need to believe that you can change. Whilst at the same time, this world has delusioned you, and do you need to ask these questions? Because I don't know. Any thoughts?
Does anybody want to comment? We're back where we started, aren't we? Can you transform, and how do you transform?
You've got to go on asking that question. But you've just got to go on asking that question. I mean, I have to go on asking that question. I mean, I'm trying to say something about that before. I think what you said is something I don't think we've quite said before, is that but perhaps I'm trying to express it in what I was saying about the theatre of good chance in the refugee camp in Calais. The fact that people have come to say, we recognise you, is itself of value. Those Albanians coming to offer their production is itself of value, almost irrespective of what the show is. I'm coming from imagery, it is metaphorically very powerful in a particular way. Okay. So I understand what you're saying. But if I say my purpose as a theatre maker is to change other people, I can't say that. That feels, how do I know how people should change? I think I recognise the good relationship when it happens, but I don't know how people should be better. I don't know that.
I don't know where to start. Yes, I do think you've got to believe, otherwise it would all be quite hopeless. And the reason why I'm here is because I do believe, and we're testing some interpersonal relationships will be built, and we're seeing it happen in our projects, and spaces will be created. How transformational and how much we can leverage that change at higher levels will always be a question for me. And again, I'm coming back to how you measure those higher level changes but I also think that transformation of the individual is very important as well. And just because it impacts that one actor is not necessarily time wasted. I don't know if that
question
really sums up your comment, but
you cannot change the world after show, but you can impact, you can contribute to the process, and for me this process is very important. And sometimes why are we putting this right to ourselves to change the world? This is our duty, not necessarily, but what we can do, we can impact. And I totally do know the story that you're telling, but definitely there are other Serbs, so it's definitely personal kind of perception. But there are other Serbs, when they saw the Kosovo production performance, and we showed that in Belgrade, they have been fascinated from the quality of the performance, and immediately they start thinking differently about the lanes. Oh, you're civilized society. So this is about the impact that I think the influence we can contribute to that super public discourse that I'm interested.
Thank you. We have to end it there. Thank you to all of the panel, not just for your expertise, but actually a modesty about what can be achieved, which one doesn't always find in peace-building circles. But I think we've not only started to push the disciplinary boundaries here, but it was a really good debate about thinking, you know, what we're doing if we're talking about this subject. So please give a round of applause.